If you're enjoying this independent podcast, I'd really appreciate it if you could take a few moments to do a review, like, share and subscribe. And if you'd like to see extra content and show your support, head to the Patreon. The link is in the show notes. It's the morning of November the 11th, 2024, in North Macedonia, and I am a few questions deep into my interview with Sam Vaknin. I'd warmed him up with the basics of what is a narcissist, how do they become one, how dangerous are they, and I paused at the end of his answer, where he went into detail about victims not being believed and their inability to put into words about what happened to them. And I've told him I understand fully what he's saying. Will rejoin with me confirming my understanding of this. What he doesn't realise is that I'm meaning I know directly after hearing from one of his own victims. I completely understand. It is such an insidious, creeping in virus. And then to try and extricate yourself is not simple. And it's not a case of, let's just use an example of a romantic situation of one partner leaves a narcissist. It's like, right, slam the door. They're not over it. It takes a long time, and I've heard you say they're not themselves. They're forever changed.
Not forever, but
sorry, forever changed for that moment, and yeah. They almost need to yeah. Go back to
regain
yeah, yeah. When you said earlier about, and this I suppose relates to some of my work, that the narcissist wants their, I'm going to say victim, person, object of focus, to die. But sometimes they do literally want them to die as well. But
it's more rare. These are psychopathic narcissists.
If they're, you know, the discard, as you call it, that there's that no one else can have you type, maybe, mentality, which might be more the psychopath, as you're saying.
The narcissist regards his the other person, and I'm saying the other person, and I'm not using the phrase intimate partner, for example, because this is not limited, contrary to
of course,
myths
yeah,
online,
yeah.
This is not limited to an intimate romantic situation.
Colleagues,
family,
friends.
Children. It's the narcissist, the only way the narcissist can relate to other people is by converting them into figments inside the narcissist's shared fantasy. By transporting them or teleporting them from reality into a totally fantastic imaginary space where the narcissist is godlike, and their role is to uphold this self-concept or self-perception and to collude and collaborate with the narcissist in bringing the shared fantasy into life as a reality. Or telling the narcissist that the fantasy is not a fantasy, that the false self is not false, that his self-image and self-perception are not erroneous. But so you have to deny yourself. In order to become a participant in the shared fantasy, the first act is to deny yourself. Because you know it's a fantasy. You know that he is delusional. You know that it's not true, and yet you repeatedly have to denounce yourself. It's like the disciples of Jesus had to deny him three times before the cock crow. So you have to deny yourself. And gradually this self-denial becomes an extensive property of you. You wake up self-denying, you go to sleep self-denying, you spend the whole day self-denying. It becomes a second habit and a second nature. It's a second nature, and self-denial becomes your identity. So you're developing what we call a negative identity. You're self-negating, self-denying, suspending yourself becomes the prerequisite and the core feature of your interaction with the narcissist. That's point number one. And then once you're inside the shared fantasy, having eliminated yourself to start with, the narcissist then treats you as if you are a non-entity externally and a full-fledged entity internally. This creates in you a dissonance. It creates in you a discrepancy. Whenever you operate as an external entity, whenever you make decisions, whenever you doubt, whenever you ask questions, whenever you develop a new friendship, whenever you travel, whenever you go to work, whenever you display signs of autonomy, personal autonomy, and self-motivation, this threatens the shared fantasy and the cohesiveness and coherence and consistency of the internal object that represents you in the narcissist's mind. So the narcissist has to suppress this. And this is the core feature of narcissistic abuse. He has to take away your agency. He has to render you utterly dependent. He has to mold you in a way that conforms 100% with the internal object, merging you in his mind with the internal object, denying you externality and separateness, treating you as an extension. There are many reasons for that. Number one, in order to participate in the shared fantasy, you need to forget your other identity. It's a little like acting. Good actors do that, yeah? When they're acting, they're not themselves. Well, hopefully. And actors that are themselves in whatever role, maybe they're not good actors. So, you're supposed to be an actress or actor, and you're supposed to deny yourself in order to conform to the role. It's a role play in the shared fantasy. But the second reason is that if you were to remain a separate external object, it would threaten the precarious balance of the narcissist's inner world. You're a systemic threat as an independent object. You're not threatening only the internal object. You're threatening the system. The system is about converting people into, you know, placeholders. So it's a very complex dance macabre, and the narcissist uses intuitively and often unconsciously, the narcissist uses amazing techniques. For example, we recently discovered, about 10 years ago, we discovered a psychological technique known as entraining or entrainment. We discovered that in musical bands, especially rock bands, the brain waves of the musicians get synchronized, and then you cannot tell whose brain waves it is. All the brain waves of all the participants in the rock band become utterly identical.
The act in concert.
They become one organism for all practical purposes, a single brain. And it's a hive mind. It's a hive mind. And so this is what the narcissist does to you. The narcissist uses entrainment to synchronize, literally, I mean physically, this is not a metaphor, to synchronize your brainwaves with his brainwaves.
You're doing that to me now.
No, not yet. Not yet. And this is done by repetition. Now, verbal abuse, for example, is highly repetitive. We discovered when we analyzed verbal abuse instances, we discovered that there is like a mantra, like a repetition. You know, the abuser repeats the same phrases over and over and over and over and over, thereby entraining you.
Brainwashing.
Yes. There is no difference in principle if the sound is music or if the sound is repeated words. We know, for example, we have rap, we have hip-hop, where repeated words are the music. They are the music. So that's one example of a technique that the narcissist uses. Narcissists use reframing a lot. Narcissists gaslight you, but not intentionally. Psychopaths gaslight you intentionally with the aim of depriving you of independent judgment and opinion and making you doubt whether you're perceiving reality appropriately. The narcissist would make you doubt your ability to gauge reality, but it's utterly instinctual on his part. He's gaslighting you instinctually. And that's because he's gaslighting himself as well. Narcissists confabulate and then they believe their own stories. They believe their own promises, their own fantasies. That's why they're very convincing. A psychopath has to work very hard to convince you. And very often you say, well, that's a con artist, you know? But the narcissist is super convincing because he himself is embedded. He has gaslit himself. He has created an alternative reality and has reified it, not only embedded himself, but he reifies it. He is that fantasy. And so there's no hint of discrepancy. There's a feeling that If he promises you something, he means it. And at the moment that he promises you something, he means it. That's why narcissists don't future fake. There's no future faking in narcissism. And so on.
Yeah, what I'm hearing from you, you know, the psychopath is just the direct, the go in, the go out, kind of, that's an exaggeration, but the narcissist is so much more stealth. And you describe it in a way that's just so, you know, there's so many experts online, but they don't have the pathology, so their view of it is from a, but do you think having the pathology is why you are so good at describing it, and like so clearly, and in a way that actually...
These self-styled experts online are very ignorant, simply. Had they been exposed to the literature in the past 120 years, they would have said the same things I do. For example, the shared fantasy has been described in 1989 by Sander. It's not my invention. Had they read Sander, they would have known that there's a shared fantasy. They're simply ignorant. They're not educated. Even those with doctor before their name. People think that if you have a doctorate in psychology, you're an expert on everything. It's nonsense. So if someone is a doctor in psychology, psychology doctor, it doesn't mean that he or she are experts on narcissism. These are subfields. It's like having an endocrinologist and a cardiologist, and you wouldn't assume that because someone is an MD, he's an expert on everything. Mm-hmm. And these people are charlatans, and many of them are con artists, because they're lying about their credentials, their experience. They have published nothing, participated in no conference. They have no previous record of study of narcissism, nothing. They're real experts, and there are many real experts. For example, Keith Campbell is a leading expert on narcissism. You wouldn't find him anywhere. He's not on YouTube. You know, he's been interviewed once or twice, I think. And you find Otto Kernberg, who is the father of the field and the grandfather of the field, and my intellectual mentor in a way, indirectly. And Otto Kernberg has I found one video with Otto Kernberg, and it has far fewer views than any self-styled expert online. Mm-hmm.
But those that you regard as the true experts, do you know if they have the pathology? And would you say that yours is unique? Because I'm trying to find an example.
You're asking if the fact that I've been diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder gives me any relative advantage in studying. You could argue it both ways. On the one hand, I have insight into my condition, which definitely provides me with material that is inaccessible to scholars who presumably are not narcissists. So Ilse Roningsten, for example, who is a expert on narcissism. Yeah. Ilse Roningsten mentioned this in one of her books. In one of her books, she mentions that my condition gives me... But you could argue it another way. You could say that my narcissism hampers my ability to, or distorts my view of the disorder. Mm. And these are two legitimate concerns. That's why I base literally all my work on the work of others. It's not that I don't innovate. I innovate a lot. But I never innovate out of thin air. Yeah. There's always a pedigree. I can always trace my work to the work of many, many other scholars. And that grounds me, despite my disorder. It grounds me. Also, there is assumption that many of these scholars are not narcissists, which I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, and you mean...
Sorry, guys, just 2 seconds. Just check the light on this.
The sun will come out. I take the opportunity while they adjust the lighting to sneak in a comment about wrestling with listening to what he's saying and knowing he's a diagnosed narcissist. I'm so torn here because, I mean, you're so likeable. You're really great company. And I'm like, you can't be all the things you describe, but... He's smiling at me while I ask. Listen carefully to his answer. And remember, he's publicly declared himself as a psychopathic narcissist. Do you regard yourself as there's an expression we use, poacher turned gamekeeper, in a way. I know, I literally just watched a video the other day which you were saying, I don't do this to be nice, I'm doing it for my intellectual gratification, I think is what you said. But then, do you view, but you are also educating people, so you are a little bit poacher turned gamekeeper.
Many narcissists, especially antisocial narcissists, also known as psychopathic or malignant narcissists, they have something known as superficial charm. Superficial charm is a clinical entity, designation, feature. And it means that they use, they turn charm on and off in order to manipulate their environment, other people, when they're goal-oriented. But this is a facade. It's a veneer. It's not even a facade, it's a veneer. And it cracks very easily. You dare disagree. You dare criticize. You dare impose your will. You dare display independence. And the facade cracks, the veneer falls apart, and the real person emerges. And the real person is essentially a bully, aggressive, domineering, and so on and so forth. But this is unique to psychopathic narcissists, which, as I said, are 3% of narcissists. The other 97% may possess superficial charm. It's an antisocial feature. But some of them don't. So not all narcissists are charming.
Yeah, and again, I've seen it a lot in my work. The recent case that we were discussing before, although I don't want to go into that one, but that, like, in the witness box, so charming, so easy to listen to, so charming, and then knowing I know what you did, it's like
that you, person you strikes me as a psychopath. Actually.
You can't, yeah. You can't marry the two. Are we okay? Everything's fine.
Yeah.
Is he bathed in sunlight now?
A bit brighter.
Do narcissists ever feel remorse for what they've done to their, I'm just going to use the word again, victims? Do they ever feel remorse?
Very few narcissists would perceive other people as victims, regardless of the nature of the interpersonal interaction or relationship. Most narcissists, not all, narcissists are human beings. There is variance. There are degrees, there are intensities, normally. I mean, we are not, even narcissists essentially are not subject to a single rule. But one could generalize and say that the majority of narcissists would self-victimize, would assume a victimhood identity. So when a narcissist is in a relationship, even when the narcissist had victimized the other person, they would reframe the situation, they would create a new narrative where this might have been, for example, inevitable or provoked or something, and then it's the narcissist who has been victimized, actually. They would claim victimhood in the situation. So narcissists regard other people in two ways. They can idealize other people or they can devalue other people. These are the two ways they relate. When the other person is idealized, this helps the narcissist idealize himself. If the narcissist, for example, is married to an ideal person, the fact that the narcissist owns this ideal person, the fact that this ideal person is the property of the narcissist, renders the narcissist ideal and perfect. It's a little like owning a flashy car. If you own a Porsche, flashy car, that makes you, you know, flashy. It's a status symbol, or kind of. So this process is known as co-idealization. So as long as the idealization continues, you can do no wrong, and the narcissist may assume responsibility for some things, and may experience remorse and guilt and shame, but not about having victimized you or having mistreated you or whatever, about having failed, having failed to manage you, having failed to make you feel good, having failed to manipulate you. So the focus or the locus of the shame, regret, and remorse, which narcissists are capable of experiencing, even psychopaths are, is on success or failure. It's results or consequences oriented. Never about what the other person feels, how the other person would experience the situation, how the long-lasting psychological consequences for the other person, abuse, trauma. This doesn't enter the narcissist or the psychopath's mind.
How how do narcissists react if they're exposed, caught, found out?
Depends. If this is done in private, the most likely reaction, the narcissist would devalue the source of the exposure. So if you were to expose the narcissist, criticize the narcissist, disagree with the narcissist, attack the narcissist, and so on and so forth, but this is done in private, just you and the narcissist very likely, most likely reaction would be to devalue you. To say, for example, well, you're too stupid to understand. Or in due time, you will realize that what you're saying is wrong. Or you're an abuser, you're victimizing me. So he would devalue you somehow. He would devalue your morality, your conduct or misconduct or attributed misconduct. He would misattribute, this is known as attribution error. He would misattribute. He would say you are a bad person, that's why you're behaving this way. So he would demonize you. And he would use a defense mechanism known as splitting. He would say, I'm all good, you're all bad. This is what children do. Children split. Children under the age of 2 actually split. And say, mommy is all good, I'm all bad, for example. This is known as the moral default. And so he would split you, and he would say, you're all bad, I'm all good. But this is when it's done in private. And this is known as narcissistic injury. Having criticized him, disagreed with him, exposed him, forced him to face his inadequacies, shortcomings, erroneous choices, wrong decisions, and so on and so forth, the narcissist is injured. The narcissist has a brittle, fragile balance between implicit self-esteem and explicit self-esteem. And when you intrude, then you force him to face reality. He resents it. It's fleeting. It's like microsecond. And immediately his grandiosity reasserts itself. His defenses emerge, and he attacks you. He does something called externalized aggression. He externalizes aggression. He attacks you in order, again, to eliminate you. To eliminate you as a source of perspicacity, as a source of insight, as a source of wisdom, so you are not worthy of consideration.
So like a smear campaign.
Kind of, yeah. You're not worthy of consideration. And whatever you say, consequently, is not worthy of consideration. So why bother? This is in private. However, if you were to do the same thing to the narcissist in public, and in front of people he values, or people he aspires to be like, or people who he identifies with, something known as narcissistic alignment. So if you do this in public, then the reaction is far more fierce.
My heart was beating out of my body at this point because this is precisely what I was about to do.
Because you will have committed what is known as, you will have engendered what is known as narcissistic mortification. Narcissistic mortification is when the narcissist is forced to come face to face with his internal shame. Narcissism, pathological narcissism, is a compensation for internal shame. The narcissist as a child is ashamed of its own helplessness, of its own inability to manipulate the adults around, of its own unlovability, of its own unworthiness. So there's a lot of shame there. By the way, everyone agrees on that. There's a lot of shame there. And narcissism is the firewall between the shame and the narcissist. The narcissist never gets in touch with this shame because this shame is life-threatening. And then you come along, you humiliate him in public, everyone is a witness, everyone smirks, he's been ridiculed, he's been mocked, he's been humiliated, he's been exposed, he's been criticized, and all the defenses crumble. It's a process known as decompensation. All the defenses crumble, and he's left face to face with this internal monster, the shame. And he has to confront his shame. And this is known as internal mortification, narcissistic mortification. At that stage, the narcissist adopts one of two solutions. But before adopting the solutions, he undergoes a phase which is indistinguishable from borderline personality disorder. Because all his narcissistic defenses have crumbled in the face of your onslaught, because you have attacked him. So the defenses crumbled, he's been besieged, and the fortress fell. So now he's skinless. There's no firewall. He's in direct touch with reality. He cannot deny anymore that having considered himself a genius, he's actually an idiot. Having considered himself drop-dead gorgeous, he's actually ugly. Having considered himself accomplished, he's actually a failure. He cannot deny this anymore. The shame is overwhelming. And the fact that this emotion is overwhelming renders the narcissist the exact clinical equivalent of someone with borderline personality disorder. And the narcissist becomes suicidal, develops suicidal ideation.
That noise is Lydia, his wife, coming in, which disrupts the filming. His mask drops. I see his annoyance. And I have to make a split-second decision, because I had been planning to confront him immediately after this answer, and Kirk, my cameraman, knew that. But he was so annoyed, I decided to abort and ask a few more questions to neutralise the energy.
Okay, let's finish this.
Sorry. Will we wait till she's laid everything down? Because the noise will interrupt. You okay?
Yeah. Are we good to go?
Yes.
Are we good to go?
Yeah, okay. Sorry, carry on.
Suicidal ideation is threatening. Emotional dysregulation, being overwhelmed.
Sorry, just a moment. Do you want him to go back a little bit? Because that was a noise.
No, I think...
Are you sure? Are you okay?
All right, okay.
All right, sorry.
Suicidal ideation is threatening. Emotional dysregulation, being overwhelmed by emotions, inability to manage emotions, drowning in emotions, is threatening. And so the narcissist has to come up with a solution. The alternative is death. 11% of people with borderline personality disorder commit death. It's the leading committer suicide. It's the leading cause of death among borderlines. So this is what the narcissist is faced with. He has to solve this somehow. And he comes up with one of two solutions. He either adopts what we call an internal solution. He says, everything that has happened, I made it happen. If she had insulted me, it's because I pushed her to insult me. I provoked her to attack me. I gave her wrong information so that she could criticize me erroneously. I orchestrated all this. Everyone here is my puppet. I'm the puppet master. That's the internal solution. It restores grandiosity. And the other solution is known as the external solution. It's when the narcissist says, I'm a victim. She's evil. What she did to me is evil. No one would have done that. Had she been a good person, she would have never done this. And everyone who has mocked me, everyone who's colluded in this spectacle is also evil. It's a conspiracy. So there's a lot of paranoid ideation involved in the external solution. The external solution leads to vengeance, vindictive behaviors, like stalking, like smear campaigns, like, while the internal solution, I made it happen, I'm the puppet master, is self-sufficient and self-contained. The narcissist's grandiosity is restored. I'm a godlike figure. Everyone here is my extension. Everything that has happened, I orchestrated. It was choreography, that's all. Then he doesn't need to do anything. And then it stops. But depends on the narcissist.
So interesting to frame it the way that it was their decision, because then it gives them the control back. So much is power and control.
Of course. One more thing in this context, if you wish.
Yeah.
If you allow. It's very interesting what you said, the issue of control. Yes, of course, it's about reasserting control as a condition for grandiosity, because God is in control. So, but sometimes narcissists preempt the inevitable narcissistic mortification. And then they indeed push people to, for example, a narcissist may say, my relationship is deteriorating, clearly. She is becoming, I'm saying she, gender pronouns are interchangeable. Half of all narcissists are women. So a male heterosexual narcissist would say, she's becoming rebellious. She is no longer a willing participant in the shared fantasy. It's all unconscious, yes? I'm anticipating abandonment and rejection. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to push her to cheat on me. I'm going to push her to infidelity. And that way, when the inevitable happens, I could tell myself that I'm the one who has orchestrated this. I'm the one who made her do this. And so this kind of narcissist would introduce his partner to eligible potential substitutes, would create situations where infidelity would emerge naturally, for example, inebriation or drug consumption. So he would truly foster a theater production or a film or an environment where his control would remain intact.
Do narcissists fear being found out or caught or exposed?
Majority of narcissists suffer from an imposter syndrome. Whatever is happening to them is unreal. Even when things happen in reality, they're incapable of perceiving reality. They have something called impaired reality testing. Reality testing is a function of the ego, in Freud's words. Reality testing is the ability to interact with reality without too many distortions, gauge reality appropriately, and then react to the information in a way that engenders or creates positive, beneficial outcomes to the individual. Narcissists don't have this. They're terrified of reality. They're also terrified of positive emotions. So they never experience reality, and they never experience positive emotions. What they do, they convert reality into a fantasy. Sometimes the fantasy is internalized, and this is known as paracosm. So the narcissist is a paracosm. And sometimes the reality is externalized, and then the narcissist coerces other people to participate in the fantasy. But it's always fantasy. There is no situation where the narcissist interacts with reality, unmediated, directly, and unfiltered. No such thing. So because this is the case, narcissists would function within the fantasy. They would function within the fantasy, and everything they do would have to conform to the narrative of the fantasy. So it's not as if you could analyze the narcissist's behaviors as, for example, goal-oriented behaviors, or as an attempt to manipulate the environment to obtain outcomes, or as normal interactions with people. That would be highly mistaken, and that's a problem with therapy with narcissists. When narcissists attend therapy, regardless of the treatment modality, could be schema therapy, could be gestalt, could be anything, when they attend therapy, the common mistake is to perceive the narcissist as someone who is embedded in reality. To perceive the narcissist as an adult, which a narcissist is not. To not realize that the narcissist is a traumatized child. And so that's why therapy fails with narcissists all the time.
So it's a bit like... I'm just going to have a quick sip, sorry.
Could you remind me of your last question? I'm sorry, my mind wandered.
Do they fear being caught out?
So, because narcissists are constantly embedded in fantasy, many narcissists have imposter syndrome. Many narcissists, deep in the recesses of their unconscious mind, if you wish, understand that they're one step removed from reality. They understand this distance somehow, because they've experienced, for example, narcissistic injuries and narcissistic mortifications. And for a brief moment, they came face to face with reality and they saw that reality has nothing to do with their fantasy. These are not intellectually challenged people. Many of them are highly intelligent. So if I, as a narcissist, were to experience narcissistic mortification even once in a lifetime, I would know from that moment on that there is a reality out there which is inaccessible to me, because I've experienced it without the benefit of the fantasy, without the benefit of the cognitive distortion known as grandiosity. This immediate, direct, unmediated contact with reality has taught me that my normal existence is not reality, is non-realistic. So this generates in narcissists a strong imposter syndrome. They can't believe that they are pulling it off. They pull the wool over people's eyes, they deceive people, they manipulate people, they obtain outcomes, they become presidents, they become... And there's a voice that keeps saying, keeps telling them, unbelievable. How did I pull it off? I mean, this is beyond belief. People must be exceedingly stupid, you know, because there is this contempt. In other words, in narcissism, the imposter syndrome serves the grandiose self-perception. Because the imposter syndrome says, I'm an imposter, and the fact that I'm successful proves that I'm vastly superior to these people. Because only that way I could have deceived them.
Hiding in plain sight.
Yes, that means I'm superior. So the imposter syndrome is the fact that the narcissist is an imposter is perceived as an accomplishment, as proof positive of the narcissist's superiority. While in normal people, healthy people, who experience imposter syndrome, this creates a dissonance. It's an unpleasant feeling. If people found out who I am, they would run the other way. If people found out who I am, I would end up in prison. If people found who I am, so it's unpleasant. You know, like, I don't want to be exposed because the outcomes would be horrible. It's a dissonant feeling. In the narcissist, it's a source of narcissistic elation. Look at me. I succeed to deceive everyone. Wow. How superior must I be? You know?
He's gesturing to all of us in the room when he says, fooling everyone. I was desperately trying to keep my composure. I tested the water with my next question to see if he'd take the bait.
Do you feel that way?
I don't deceive. I don't have to deceive. I think when narcissists are truly endowed, for example, they are, in fact, intellectually superior. There's no need for these stratagems anymore. I think these are compensatory stratagems. For example, a narcissist who perceives himself as a genius, and he's not, in reality he's not, would need these bridges, these stratagems to deceive himself, basically. But a narcissist who is truly endowed, and there are many narcissists who are truly talented, truly geniuses, truly, they don't need these things anymore. They have it. They... Understand what I'm saying? There's no need for compensation. Mm-hmm. But for example, a narcissist would self-deceive where there's no comparative advantage. For example, a narcissist who is truly a genius, but not exactly drop-dead gorgeous, would deceive himself as far as his looks go. Mm-hmm. He would deceive himself about his looks. Mm-hmm. He would say, I'm a genius, but I'm also very attractive. You know, and then when a potential partner would react, when a woman would be attracted to him, he would say, "Wow, she must be blind. I'm truly superior in this sense."
Yeah, yeah. So you're saying basically that the narcissists do have an awareness that they've done wrong, I suppose, and they do fear being found out because of the way they might be exposed, and particularly in public, but they won't necessarily feel remorse unless it's them losing the Ferrari as you described. But there, I guess what I'm getting at is there's an awareness of wrong and right, and there's awareness that they've done wrong, but what they will feel is, rather than I'm scared to be found out, they'll be like, elated because they're getting away with it and hiding in plain sight.
Yeah, the only precedent I'm aware of was in the Blackwell case in the United Kingdom, where narcissistic personality disorder was accepted as a defense, an insanity defense, basically. Let's be clear. It is the view of major scholars, such as Otto Kernberg, and minor scholars, such as Sam Vaknin, that narcissistic personality disorder is a severe mental health issue. Some say the second most severe mental health issue after schizophrenia, because it involves a total ruination of all psychological processes and the ability to interact with reality. In a sense, it's a form of psychosis. It's a kind of reverse psychosis. It's a pseudo-psychosis. So it's really bad, really bad. And many things are affected. But one of the things that's not affected is the ability to tell right from wrong, the ability to choose. We know that because, for example, when narcissists go to prison, all their narcissistic behaviors vanish. They're no longer disempathic, or they're no longer exploitative, they're no longer arrogant, suddenly they are good citizens in prison. Because if you are a narcissist in prison, your longevity may be curtailed to some extent.
This was my moment. And if you're wearing headphones while listening to this, you can actually hear my heart pounding.
So are you aware of the bad that you have done in your life?
My private life is out of limits, as I thought we had agreed.
Oh, yeah, yeah, but I'm talking about, you know, professionally. Are you aware?
Are narcissists aware?
No, you as in your profession.
Oh, so you're talking about my private life.
I thought
we had an understanding not to include my private life.
Because I do have to ask about your work and your work.
Yeah, my work has nothing to do with
it. As a professional and taking advantage of victims through your role, through your profession.
I don't say that I'm taking advantage. All my work is free online.
Well, but what I have seen is hundreds and hundreds of documents which have been shown to me, including photographic evidence of wrong that you have done to victims, to therapy patients, and you in your professional role taking advantage of them, impacting them psychologically, and abusing them, sexual coercion, infecting them knowingly with HPV, sleep deprivation,
utterly unaware of these
contracts of behavior. I have been shown this, and I need to ask you about that.
I'm sorry, this is outside the confines of what we have agreed.
But it's important for me to address.
Well, you asked and I answered.
You haven't answered me. Do you know that you've done wrong to these women?
I'm sorry, but we have agreed not to discuss my private life. And of course, I have not done wrong to anyone, as far as I know.
But using your own, what you just explained to me is that you would know that you've done wrong when people are saying you've been hurt.
Had I done wrong, I would have known that I've done wrong, of course.
So if we were to look through the documents and photographs of you that you've had sexual relationships or
coercion
with patients.
We have an agreement not to discuss my private life.
It's not private, it's your job, it's your profession.
Okay.
You're a therapist and you have vulnerable patients who come to you for help.
I'm a professor of psychology, but...
Yes, but you work as a, you work in that role as a counsellor for women.
If you persist with this line, in contravention of what we've agreed.
It's not contravention because it's my duty as a professional to look at how you conduct yourself as a professional, and I need to address that with you.
But that's not the topic.
And is there anything
that to discuss?
Do you feel bad for what you've done to these women?
I am not going to.
When they come to you and they're broken and they need help?
Can you tell me if you have proof that he has the...
No, don't engage in this conversation.
I have proof.
No, I have proof for her.
It's been a pleasure. You may use the material that I've given you.
But I want to give you this opportunity to speak.
You can want whatever you want. I cannot prevent you from wanting.
But do you think you deserve to be in jail?
I'm available to continue to talk to you on narcissistic personality disorder as an expert on the topic.
Do you think you deserve...
And if you don't, then...
To be brought to account for what you've done? Is there anything that you would want to say to these women?
Ayla, I suggest that we terminate. How do we close this?
It's hard for me to say this to you because, you know...
You have my permission to use the material that we have shot until now, okay? And I'm again offering
you... But are you denying
you
what I'm asking you?
Okay.
Are you denying what I'm asking you, Sam?
Were you paid someone to ask questions?
No. Because
there is a group of...
As a professional, it's my job and my duty to do my due diligence.
I will show you my photos when I joined my husband
Lydia, you're very wrong in what you're saying right now.
Did you hear that? He's admitting he had sex with his patients.
Don't participate in this.
I witnessed, so it's not okay. It's not okay that you are insisting on something. I have proof. I will show you.
I have to do my due diligence, and that is when I have been informed of stuff that I need to address, because it's important.
I'm also here. You can.
Yeah, just let's pick our things.
No, do you still want to give them the books?
Yeah, well.
She awkwardly handed me his books.
This is my collection of Sam's articles that he was publishing in various media. And this is the famous Malignant of Law. Enjoy that. Thank you very much for everything.
Their departure was excruciatingly long.
Shall we wait for mine?
No, it's not okay.
I will wait.
Okay, Ayla, take care, and have a safe trip back, okay? Take care.
One of the most bizarre moments, we shook hands.
Did I take my coat? Oh.
No.
Did I forget anything? Let's just make sure. No, I think I did. Well,
he even rifles through his little bag for no apparent reason. It's like he didn't want to leave.
I have to be professional, Lydia, and those things are important.
You're right, of course, but we had an agreement as to the topics.
But it's not personal.
It is personal.
It's professional, but I can't have someone as an...
And this is unethical behavior on your part.
Well, I disagree.
You could have written to me, listen, this is what I would like to discuss, and then I would have agreed or disagreed. But to spring it as a kind of trap, that is extremely unethical behavior, and you should know that as a documentarist.
It's important.
I'm not referring now to the veracity or the falsehood of the claims, but the way you've done it is highly unethical. Okay, Ayla, take care.
I disagree.
I think what
I've seen is unethical and damaging and criminal. I have been shown.
Can you send me proof, please?
Things will unfold in the proper manner.
Show me. Please show me. Send it to me. I will give you my... Actually, you have my email address in the book. Please do send me. Mm. Please. Otherwise, I will complain. Not here. I.
Okay. Take care.
Bye.
They went out but stood on the landing with the door still open. We shut the door. Even once they went outside the door of the apartment, they were there for what seemed like an eternity. Their cameraman came back inside for something and then finally closed the door.
Have you got everything?
I rushed to the spy hole. He just said it's a trap. Sam was looking on his phone.
stairs, or do you think that's antagonizing?
Yeah, it is.
Might as well.
Kirk filmed them from above as they made their way down the many stairs.
What you expected?
No, that's not the reaction I expected. I'm shaking. I'm really surprised. He did not want to let his professional... He would have carried on the interview if I had ignored that. I think he had to take a moment standing out there, and that's when he said, "It's a trap." I expected more of an explosion, I expected more of a... But I think he liked me, or narcissists don't like people, but he wanted the benefit so much of what I was proposing that he... It was so bizarre, and Kirk, you knew what was coming. And listening to all his answers, like literally describing the possibilities of what might happen when confronted, he was literally detailing them. And I kept trying to find my moment to go in there and say, what about what you've done? And I think it took him a moment to kind of, to twig what I was talking about, until I said, you know, I'm absolutely shaking. But I did it, and I feel like I've got a response, or I'd at least got the questions to him that were really important to make, and it was very intriguing. And I kind of need to, I'll need to watch it back to fully take it in, because I don't think I could properly take it in at the time. But oh God, actually, let me go and call them and tell them now. We'll film it.
And could you what reaction did you expect, and what did you get?
I expected him to explode. I expected him to very quickly realise what was going on. But it was almost awkward, because he sat there and I was glad to have that opportunity to ask more and more and more. But then he had his cameraman here, and his wife was here, and then the wife realises. And then, I don't know how many minutes it took, because it felt like forever, this awkwardness. I was expecting it to be a boom up and out the door as fast as possible, but it was quite calm and slow and almost a little bit organized. And sorry, I don't know if it's me shaking or because it's so cold outside with the door open, but a very unexpected reaction there.
And do you think
can't quite take it in.
Do you think he's maybe learned from it? You've watched YouTube videos in the past, and that of him exploding for different reasons.
I've seen
do you
him
think he's learned from that, that maybe he shouldn't put that facade on?
I don't know, because narcissists don't like people, but I think he really wanted to intellectually be gratified by what he thought he was doing here. And I think that's... I just did precisely what he talked about, which was exposing him in public. And he explained the things that happened, like, was it mortification, basically? And for the first time, they might have the reality of, like, having to face, like, oh dear. So I think that's possibly what happened, but there will be an explosion out of here. He was very aware to tell her not to continue speaking, and they wanted to get out of there, so yeah.
And...
Were you surprised?
Yeah, I was surprised. I expect him to explode, yeah. I was kind of waiting for getting the adrenaline rush that you were getting as well.
Yeah.
I was relieved there hadn't been an explosion. The adrenaline was still pumping through me and my mind racing, and I had to call Mark and Scott to let them know what happened. But I'm going to save that for the next episode and let you, the listeners, absorb what you've heard. You're going to learn later from someone who knows Sam well that, in his opinion, he was far from calm. In the next episode of The Narcissist Playbook, Sam's former business partner gives his reaction to the confrontation.
Yeah, it's a good result. Mm-hmm. He's fucked. He's fucked.
And gives an insight into Sam's body language.
He was very, very angry. Very angry. And scared. And a little bit in shock. I think what he's imagining is a pending court case.
And finally, I reveal myself and my mission to one of Sam's victims.
And I put it to him what he's done to all of you. And we've got him on camera. And we've got him.
The storyteller Narcissist Playbook is written, produced and edited by me, Isla Traquaire. And it's the fourth in the Storyteller series. This is an independent production. And I rely on you, the listeners, to help spread the word by showing your support. It doesn't cost anything, just a few clicks to like, share, subscribe and review. And soon there'll be extra content available on my Patreon for the price of a cup of coffee, including analysis, evidence, regular videos and more. Thank you for listening. If you've been affected by narcissistic abuse, there are links for support in the show notes.